I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Future Farmers may be the least likely name for an artist's collaborative, but it does indeed describe the work of artist Amy Franceschini, now quite literally. As winner of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art's recent commission, Amy is using an inspiration from World War II-era America to spark a citizen movement to make San Francisco the Garden City. Amy is our guest today on Smart City. Also with us from San Francisco is Dr. Isabel Wade, founder of the Neighborhood Parks Council. It's an open-source network of citizen volunteers using technology and political pressure to keep the city's parks maintained. We'll talk with two remarkable entrepreneurs who are greening San Francisco today on Smart City, right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Amy Franceschini is a San Francisco-based artist-designer. In 1995, she co-founded Atlas, an online magazine. She's taught at art and design schools in San Francisco and currently teaches as a lecturer at Stanford University in the art department. Amy's work is rooted in environmental and community-related interest and has been shown internationally on and offline. Amy is the founding member of Future Farmers. Amy, what were you trying to accomplish with the founding of Future Farmers?
With the founding of Future Farmers, I don't think I was necessarily trying to accomplish anything in particular. It was more a solidification of a process that had developed over about 3 years of time. And the name actually came from my childhood background, where I grew up in the San Joaquin Valley of California. My father was a big-time farmer. He farmed about 5,000 acres of row crops. And then he and my mother divorced when I was five, and she moved to the West Coast and became an organic farmer. And he was remaining a industrial farmer and owned a pesticide company. So I grew up between these two kind of opposing ideologies, and it very much influenced my work because I was very interested in farming on both ends of the spectrum, because both are highly politicized, whether you're trying to remain a small-time organic farmer or trying to deal with the changing politics in water and pesticides and industrial farming. So I guess with Future Farmers, I'd looked at the kind of work I was doing, and I wanted to continue thinking about what our food consumption in the future would be like and what the processes we were using in the early 80s when I started thinking about this, how they would change over time. And I wanted to stay connected to that. So I thought if I called my business and my collective Future Farmers, that it would continuously be swirling around in my mind.
And is it?
Yes, every day. And I think another aspect of Future Farmers was I always wanted to live on a farm in the future and continue what I was doing. And Future Farmers embodies several different aspects, but one is a residency program where we invite international artists to come and reside at Future Farmers for up to 6 months and produce work together with us and on their own. And we sort of act as a mentorship. But I was always dreaming that this would happen on a farm, and that it wouldn't only be about producing art, but that it would also be about growing our own food together and eating together, because I feel like that's very much part of our process, is sharing our eating time together. And that's where the most interesting things happen.
And have you moved in that direction?
I've been looking at land for the last 5 years, but I haven't found anything that's feasible yet.
I want to talk to you about a residency program. What does it take to really make a residency work? You bring in an artist. I assume you're very familiar with the artist's work, but not necessarily his or her personality and his style of working. How do you quickly integrate a resident artist into a collective, a collaborative, and make work together?
I think I've been really lucky because all of them have worked out really well, and I have never met any of them face-to-face before they've come. It's all been through email exchange.
Wow.
But I think giving an artist, based on an artist's work, the merit of an artist's work, giving an artist a space and time to create is usually enough. and we do offer some financial support. I think that our studio is so kind of chaotic and so many different types of projects come through the studio that artists can kind of latch on to wherever they feel comfortable or feel interested. And we just try to keep it as open as possible. And most every single time someone has come, it's turned into an interesting collaboration, or someone has just created their own new body of work and we've just sort of served as a mentor or kind of a support effort.
I'm very interested in how what works in the world of artists can be translated to out into a broader world, a world of not of art necessarily, but certainly of creativity and in addressing problems that exist in society or taking advantage of opportunities that may be emerging. I'm wondering if you've thought enough about the actual process of creation when it comes to art, and particularly as it comes to collaboration, that you could say, well, here's some do's and don'ts, or here are some things that make collaborations really soar versus things that hold them back and crimp the work.
I think for me, collaboration is very important on many levels. One, because I think a project becomes way more than it can be with an individual artist creating a single body of work, because so many different voices become involved. And of course, there's always compromises on many levels due to time and personalities and interests. But for me, the collaborative effort is a portrait of society. I feel like each project I have, there is a base of artists that I have collaborated with over the years, but I usually invite some new artists based on the content, or it doesn't always have to be an artist, it can be a scientist or a politician. But through the project and through the creation of a project, the relationships that are built with those people are always somehow insightful into relating to other people in the world. And I think having to deal with people that don't necessarily think in the same way as you is really important. It's a hurdle and it's scary. for instance, the last project I worked on, I worked with politicians, and we think in very different ways, but I think we're both very excited about each other's worlds and can really inspire each other, because I think politics can be very dry and bureaucratic, and it can kind of lose the spirit of what art can be. And I think art can be so irrational in a way, which is the beauty of it. But to bring those two worlds together for me was very exciting. And I think on both ends of the spectrum, the politicians I worked with, I think, also enjoyed the process.
Tell me about the project.
So for this was the most recent project I did, and it was for the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art SECA Award show, where every 2 years, the museum offers an award to 5 artists. It's a small stipend, and I proposed to reinstate a 1943 government program called Victory Gardens. And if you're not familiar with it, it was a program during World War I and World War II, started by the Department of Agriculture and Civilian Defense to basically get Americans to grow their own food, and also they started a lot of conservation efforts, but it was to offset food production for the war effort. There was a lot of other things tied into this program in terms of boosting national morale, and they sort of portrayed this program as a way for citizens to become involved in the war. So they were basically like, if you grow your own food, you become a soldier for the war. This part of the program I was not excited about or interested in, but I was interested in the fact that this program was a massive participation in America. So within that, the program was started in 1941, and the Department of Agriculture distributed pamphlets all over to every city in America as a guide to how to start a Victory Garden program in your city. And within 2 years, cities adopted the program, and there was 43 million families growing food and 8 million tons of food being produced within 2 years.
Wow.
And that really struck me as, I feel like right now I'm a teacher at many schools in San Francisco, and I feel like within the youth culture, there's this sort of, it's not necessarily apathy, but this feeling that nothing can be done to make our society better. There's sort of a roadblock. And looking at this time in history where massive amounts of people participated in a program and were actually successful in succeeding in something, I wanted to shine a light on that and try to think about how that would work in a contemporary context. So I did a lot of research about the Victory Gardens program. I went to the San Francisco Library and found this image of San Francisco City Hall with a Victory Garden in front of it. So it's a little farm in front of City Hall. And this image really struck me. Like, we actually had a demonstration garden in Civic Center, and it made me think about Civic Center and City Hall and the function of that space. And in my mind, that's our space. That's the people's center. That's the people's house. We elect these people to take care of our house, and it should be our home. And it should also demonstrate innovative ideas. And it did so in 1943. So I approached Matt Gonzalez, who was president of the Board of Supervisors probably 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago. He ran for mayor, the last mayoral election against Newsom as a Green representative, and he lost. But it was a very exciting time where many people who weren't politicized became politicized to support Matt Gonzalez because he was professing things that a lot of people believed in, and also he was very progressive. So I approached him just to ask him, like, what would be the possibility of reinstating a program like Victory Gardens today, and how would I go through the political hurdles to actually get support or have an ear listen to my proposal? And so he thought it was a great idea. He thought the image I had from the library was so strong, it had a historical precedent, that would give us some momentum. So he put me in touch with Aaron Peskin, who's president of the Board of Supervisors, and I presented my idea to him. And the idea was to start a city-supported home gardening program, which is what Victory Gardens was, which included subsidized seeds and tools and lessons, and to start a city seed bank so that people who were growing their food in the backyard would also save their seeds and contribute their saved seeds to a seed bank. And that would lend itself to food security and also sustaining basically a food stock, a seed stock, that was specific to San Francisco that could grow in the conditions here and be a stronger food crop. And the third thing was to get a piece of land in the city. The big dream was to have a plot in Golden Gate Park where we would have a teaching garden and a facility to have people come and have workshops. So Aaron Peskin was very interested, and he said, okay, let's have a meeting and invite many city offices to talk about this. He was very positive. So we had a second meeting in his office, and I felt like I needed a partner. I was an artist with an idea that was gaining momentum, but I'm not a gardener for sure. I have a green thumb, but I didn't want to take on the role of being the city gardener. So I partnered with Blair Randall from the Garden for the Environment, which is a teaching garden in the Inner Sunset. And we together presented Victory Gardens to the city, to the Public Utilities Commission, to the Department for the Environment, to the Department of Family and Health, to Public Health, and I think three other offices. And they were all very, very positive. And the Department for the Environment was so excited. They said, come down to our office. Let's talk about this further. And so Jared Blumenfeld from the Department of the Environment offered to help us in any way possible. And so from that point forward, which was about January of this year, we planted three gardens in the city, and I did this with the money from the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. And we put a listing on Craigslist saying we're giving three gardens away as part of this pilot project, and we want them to be in the three different microclimates of San Francisco because there's very different climates here. And you have to take an oath to grow your garden for at least 2 years and be part of a program where people can tour your backyard to see the progress of this project. And so within 8 hours, we had about 700 responses from Craigslist.
Wow.
With complete diatribes of why people should have a garden. Some were single mothers who couldn't afford to buy organic food for their kids. Some were people with AIDS who needed very controlled food supply. Other people were just, you know, enthusiasts. But it was very evident at that point that people want to grow their own food. They're concerned about their food, the health of their food, and they feel from these mails and from further research we've done, it feels like people don't know anything about the food they're eating or where it comes from, and they'd like to know more. So we picked three people and planted gardens in each of the backyards and started a website and started a garden registry where we're basically asking people to register their gardens. So we're looking at already existing gardens so that we can see who's already gardening and how much space that is in total, to kind of get a momentum going for other people to garden.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, we are basically letting these gardens grow and doing a bit more research. The Board of Supervisors basically met and gave us funding through the Department for the Environment to next year hire a gardener and have money to do development of the program. So January 1st, Victory Gardens will be moving ahead, and we're going to be hiring a gardener and developing a campaign and basically organizing the distribution of starter kits throughout the city so that people can just go buy a very inexpensive raised bed, soil, timer, and have free lessons on how to install this and grow food.
And as you pursue this project, Amy, do you still feel like you are acting in the role of artist, or have you moved on to some other role of organizer, community activist? I mean, or do you wear all those hats at once?
I definitely get confused myself sometimes, but when I step into a city meeting, I think also my partner in Garden for the Environment was formerly, he's an artist and he worked as a curator. We very much feel like we are putting on a performance and that the energy we have to harness to profess our love for what we're doing is a very creative energy. And I think that's what's given us so much momentum with the city. Like every time we go, we have a very creative presentation. It's not necessarily a PowerPoint presentation or a stack of paper in front of a group of people. I think if we do a PowerPoint presentation, we make an interesting movie or we kind of put in an art context to the presentation.
But they loved having meetings with you after the PowerPoints they must have to suffer through.
It seems like we get a very positive response. I think that the project definitely has been questioned as whether it's art or activism. And I think in my work, I would hope that we wouldn't have to draw those kind of boundaries because I think that keeps people from being an artist or being an activist, those boundaries.
How do you mean?
I just think that by categorizing something, you're defining it and you kind of know exactly what it is. And maybe people would be afraid to be an activist because it's too hardcore or it's, you know, too specific, and an artist is maybe too irrational or you know, there's not enough definition around it. And I think I would hope that these kind of worlds would merge and that we wouldn't necessarily have to have rubrics around them.
As an artist, I mean, you're obviously thinking about how you and your work can shape your city, San Francisco. Talk to me a little bit about what you see the potential. I mean, you are actually planting gardens and changing the city in a physical way and ultimately perhaps in an economic way. I mean, do you think about that when you begin a project? Are you thinking about the impact it's going to have beyond the world of art?
I think I always am, but I always think that that's just a very utopian aspect of the project and that, especially with Victory Gardens and other projects, I think, you know, I read about the Victory Gardens program in a book, the 1943 version, and the first seed of inspiration was like, wow, what if that could happen again? And just think of the effects and what if every city adopted it again? And what if it, you know, San Francisco became a model for other cities to follow and that it was an open model? And, you know, so I'm thinking on a very grand scale, but then I think I'm one person. How can this ever happen? So I'm going to focus on I'm going to push forward the utopian side of this, but I'm going to go super utopian. So for the San Francisco exhibition, I built a wheelbarrow bike that's, you know, sort of impossible to ride, but it implies this sort of positive and it's an entry point to more information. And I proposed that there'd be a fleet of these bikes and city gardeners that would be dressed in these uniforms that I designed. And I think once the reality set in, I was a bit scared. Like, wow, this can happen. And what does it mean now that I'm participating in something that's not just a fantasy? And I think that becomes a new challenge and an exciting challenge, because it's a different mind that you use when you're dreaming and fantasizing about something that remains in a kind of safe world of art versus something that is going to be in a person's backyard. And if they eat the food, it has to be good. And, you know, there's all these kind of reality sets in. And it does, for me, it becomes to be less fantastical. But I think that's the effort in this project, is to keep it fantastical and to keep it interesting. And I think that's what's been making it forge ahead so much.
You've said that your work in part is a reminder that we have to nurture our creativity. As an artist, how do you do that? And what about that can non-artists use to sustain their creativity?
I think I feel lucky because I surround myself with artists. All my friends are artists, and I get a lot of inspiration from them and continued support. But I think as a non-artist, it's really important to challenge yourself to do things that you don't understand and to go places you've never been before, walk on a different path than you normally walk, just something to jar yourself out of a routine that might turn you inward rather than outward. I just think it's so easy to become part of a routine and part of a system that can be deadening, and it's life is so exciting, and we need to stay on that shore of excitement.
Amy Franceschini is a San Francisco-based artist designer who conceived Victory Gardens. After a short break, we'll find out how committed San Francisco citizens are making a big difference in the maintenance of their parks. But first, Planet Edison assistant editor Nate Berg has the latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development.
Have planners and social scientists been wrong all along? Could greater diversity actually be bad for cities? New research from Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam suggests it is, and that as demographics get more and more mixed, the situation will only get worse. At issue are Putnam's findings that the greater the diversity in a city, its residents are less civically engaged. This amounts to fewer people voting, volunteering, giving to charity, and even trusting their neighbors. The greatest diversity is often found in cities, and the mix of many ethnic backgrounds, incomes, and education levels tends to increase people's perception of alienation. This, Putnam's research argues, keeps people primarily to themselves and to their families, and effectively removes them from civic life. Meanwhile, rail advocates in Central Florida are celebrating the recent approval of a long-sought commuter rail system. The plan had been in the works for nearly 18 years and will consist of a 61-mile system connecting cities in four counties near Orlando. Residents and transit advocates have welcomed the approval of the $615 million project, which many in the state hope will reduce the region's thick traffic congestion. The Orlando Sentinel reports that developers have already begun releasing plans for transit-oriented housing and office developments near the system's routes, and public officials are anticipating substantial job growth due to their city's newfound accessibility. Many have high hopes for the system, which is set to open in 2010, but the work has only just begun. Not even the land for the system or the rights of way for its tracks have been purchased. But while commuter rail is on the rise in Florida, magnetic levitation rail may be on its deathbed in China. The world's only public maglev rail system in operation has had such little commercial success that many economists are saying it will never be embraced on a global scale. The International Herald Tribune reports that the Chinese maglev train system serving Shanghai has seen less than one quarter of its expected demand, and that unless the system shows more success, other countries will be, and already are, incredibly hesitant to spend the billions of dollars on their own maglev lines. And although 9 projects are currently under consideration in the U.S., funding limitations have kept them from moving anywhere beyond the drawing board. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of Planetizen. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Dr. Isabel Wade is executive director of the Neighborhood Parks Council in San Francisco, where she and 2,000 volunteers are working to restore and improve the maintenance of the city's parks and playgrounds. She's been in the forefront of the park advocacy movement in San Francisco for more than 10 years. In March 2000, Dr. Wade and the NPC spearheaded a coalition of other nonprofits to pass two ballot initiatives that would begin the restoration of city parks and the acquisition of open space. How does ParkScan work?
Well, ParkScan is a web-based tool for citizens to report conditions in their parks. And they use it by having access to the World Wide Web, so either with their own computer at home, at the office, or if they don't have a computer, they can go usually to the public library or another public place that has computers for the public to use. And the citizens basically just are walking through their park and they might notice something that needs repair. The irrigation sprinkler head is broken and it's gushing water, or there's a lot of garbage in some place in the park, or there's graffiti on the rec center wall. And so they might note all three of those things if they're all there. And when they get back to a computer, they simply go on a website, parkscan.org, and there's a set of pull-down menus. Right now, this is just for San Francisco, but we are trying to go national. And so there's a set of pull-down menus starting with, you know, even what neighborhood are you in? They might not know the name of the park, but if they know the neighborhood, then they can say that, or they can say the name of the park. And then based on the park, there's a set of other pull-down menus because we know the features in all the park and it's all been pre-programmed in these menus. And they just can quickly report. And they have to do a report for each condition, but it's all very fast. And then they get a number. And this is one of the most important features, at least from the citizens' perspective, but also from the cities, which I'll tell you about in a minute. But from the citizens, the minute they send their report, they will get an email back from our server giving them an ID number and thanking them for participating. And that ID number is the number they can use then to go back in the next day, the next week, and check what response our city has made to fixing the condition that they reported. Now, the city also gets the email, and so then right away we've put the notification pretty much as directly to the person responsible as we can. So that person in the Rec and Park Department, it might be actually in the Art Commission or the Department of Public Works. I mean, there's about eight different agencies that we send it to, depending on their jurisdiction. But they then get the email and they'll know, sometimes it's highlighted that it's a safety concern. So they're very anxious to get these and fix them right away that day or within 24 hours. Likewise, graffiti, a special unit goes out for graffiti, and that's fixed generally within 48 hours. So those kinds of notifications get really immediate results. And then the Parks Department, you know, staff respond within hopefully a reasonable time to what the other conditions are and what they're going to do about them. Some of them, of course, are capital needs. In other words, expensive fixes that they might have to wait for a bond or something. But we've found often the public just wants to know, why is something continuously broken? Well, if the park department doesn't have the money, they do understand that. They just really want to know. And then that might even help, as we have found, with people being aware of the system needs and then being willing to vote for a bond when it goes on the ballot.
What are the most common complaints about San Francisco's parks that come through ParkScan?
The most common complaints are graffiti and garbage, and then broken equipment. And interestingly, last year in our annual report, in really looking at all the data from all the parks that were reported on, I mean, those kinds of things, of course, are vandalism. It's not a fundamental problem of the park system. It's people, people doing bad things to parks. So how the system also works is we were able to make the case for the first time this year because we had this real data that clearly it isn't the Parks Department's fault and they can't be expected to be doing that. But if they had park rangers in the parks that might stop people from, you know, littering and graffitiing and so on, then that could make a real difference for the city because it costs the city a lot of money to go and fix these conditions. So this year, the mayor put in the budget, there's going to be 8 new park rangers. So that's another aspect of the ParkScan system that, you know, at first I think maybe the Parks Department thought like it was kind of the citizens spying on them. But I think now they get it that, oh, citizens just really care about these things. And then when they find out we can't fix some of them because we don't have the resources, they actually go and advocate for us. So,
which is a great partnership.
Yes.
Let me ask you something. In the beginning, I mean, you're sending, if I understand the system, Isabel, correct me if I'm wrong. If I come home and after I've been through a park, I make a complaint via the website, parkscan.org. Mm-hmm. That complaint, I presume, not only goes to the Neighborhood Parks Council, the organization sponsoring parkscan.org, but it also then goes, I would assume, to some central place at the city, plus the person who would be directly responsible for taking care of the complaint. Is that about the way the system works?
Yes, almost. The complaint does come through our server and automatically goes to the correct city agency, which usually is the Park Department, but sometimes it's a few of the other agencies as well. There's no central place that it goes, although very soon, in the next couple of months, we will be, parkscan.org, will be the public portal for the 311 system in San Francisco.
I was going to ask you about 311.
And so when the public calls in at 311, because often people, interestingly, don't know where to call or don't know where to get the numbers to call the city, and then soon they'll all learn 311. And so then they will have a park report. The person sitting at the 311 center in San Francisco is going to be calling up on their website. As soon as they hear park, they're going to call up our parkscan.org website and they will file the park report on that 311 system.
Wow. So parkscan.org will essentially function as the 311 communication mechanism once a call comes in, but only for parks.
Only for parks, correct.
Interesting. That's a great service. So let me come back and ask the question I intended to ask, and that was, when you first set this up, you said that the city was a little bit leery. These citizens are spying on us, but they must have agreed to take the complaints because they otherwise the complaints wouldn't be going to them, I presume.
That's exactly right, and that actually that. Acceptance took some vision both by our mayor and the then general manager of the Parks Department.
So Mayor Gavin Newsom, are
Mayor
we talking
Gavin about? Newsom, and then the general manager, who was Elizabeth Goldstein at the time, she actually saw this as an important tool to improve the efficiency of the Parks Department and to improve customer service. So she got it and decided that the Park Department would implement it. And, you know, and that was a bold move on her part. I mean, the mayor wanted to do it, but she did too, because the people below her at that point, it's probably fair to say most of them were not enthusiastic.
And I'll bet it is fair to say that.
And one of the problems, in fairness at that point, was a lot of the people below the two or three top people in the Park Department didn't even have computers. So, you know, there was actually a real challenge for us and the department in getting them the equipment and training them on the use of it and how to get into our ParkScan system to get their reports and how to respond. And so, really, that took about 3 or 4 years for us, everybody, to get used to it and to do it. Now, we did have a little problem for a while that the staff, they were doing the work. That was the good news. The field staff were doing the work, but their supervisors weren't going back into the system and closing out, what we call closing out, saying that the work was done so the public would know. So then a new manager came in at a certain point a couple of years ago, and when we made him aware that this was a problem and that we wanted the department to get credit for what they did, but if people just looked randomly on the reports, it looked like they weren't doing anything. So it was either us going to the media or him figuring out how to get them to close out. And so he just simply put it in their job responsibilities and said, you know, now you will be graded in the future on whether you close out your park scan reports. So that boosted up the rate of closure dramatically. And I don't think any of them really have a problem now that they're used to doing it.
Let me ask you something. So the Parks Department, when it in effect closes out or has a response, takes care of the complaint, they report, I assume, back to you through your system and to the complainant?
Yes, correct. They report back to us in the system, and then we actually report to the complainant.
I see. So the loop is closed all the way back to the person who made the complaint.
Correct.
And how you said that the reaction time on safety issues is within 24 hours, typically. Graffiti,
yes.
48 hours.
Yes.
What about other kinds of complaints? You said garbage is one of the main complaints, as is broken equipment.
Yes.
What are you looking at there?
Yeah, so garbage can be usually dealt with, I'd say, between 24 and 72 hours, often within the 24, because they know that's something that the public just really hates to see.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really pretty fast with garbage. And then broken things take longer. And really, some of these conditions have been, you know, on the list for months. And that's because either they don't have the parts, they are out short on the labor to go and fix the, you know, item. And of course, only the correct person can actually do the work in our city. So if they're sick, then, you know, you might be waiting a long time, or it might be such a big project that it actually has to go on the finance request list.
Right. And how do they report back on things like that, that are going to take, you know, some time to fix?
Yes. Well, then they, when they're, you know, get on the program and they have to type in a response, they simply say, this is a long-term capital project. We hope it'll be, if they know, for example, we're just about to do a bond, they can say it's one of the 11 projects on the bond thing, or they'll say it'll be eligible for the 2011 bond or other financing mechanism. You know, every year, sometimes the budget has a little, there's a little extra money. And now one of the exciting things about this program and actually our kind of organizing of park groups in the city is they know that they can go pressure their member of the board or like their city council member. And we've gotten extra money for capital projects for our groups that way.
Is there any pattern in terms of where people are most likely to report complaints? I mean, are you seeing those complaints situated more in neighborhoods that have access, easy access to computers, for instance?
Yes, I think that's actually true. I mean, we're a pretty wired city, so actually there's a lot of access even in other neighborhoods that you'd think might not have access. I think, however, what's more interesting, I mean, one issue maybe for some people, just you don't want to be bothered if you don't have a computer, and so that slows things down. But if you're not in the habit of making complaints to the city and getting any results, then you might not think to do this, because people feel kind of hopeless and disconnected from the city in some neighborhoods. And so that's was a barrier to start. We're kind of excited that little by little, as people are hearing about the program, and we do a lot of outreach and trying to get every neighborhood to participate, they're starting to see results. And then they get really excited that they've become empowered to make an impact. So, for example, in the Mission District in San Francisco, which has a lot of Latin people living there, one of our best success stories is a little mini park that got organized. And then so not only reporting on ParkScan, but then they got inspired about what they could do and they lobbied for more money and they got a little grant. And so they've redone their playground and they're a really active park group now. So we're very excited about that.
Do you get only complaints through parkscan.org or occasionally do you get a suggestion?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that because we actually have one of the pull-down items is where you make kudos, where you make compliments.
Ah.
So it isn't even just suggestions. It's like sometimes people are thrilled, first of all, if somebody fixed something and then they go and see it and they're just so thrilled. So they'll write back and say, thank you so much. Or let's say some of the gardeners are just outstanding and making, you know, beautiful flower beds or something.
That's nice.
So people definitely send in compliments. And then sometimes they make suggestions. We put a sort of, we knew people would want to talk, so to speak. And so you can do that on the bottom. That doesn't necessarily go straight through to the park department. In fact, it doesn't. We read all of those because, of course, sometimes people are really irate. And frankly, there's nothing the Parks Department can do about certain things. And if people are rude and so on, we just don't send those forward. I mean, there's no point.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's a good suggestion, yes, then we read that. And we might send that directly to the general manager or to the three top superintendents and say, gosh, you know, here's a good idea.
Isabel, you are the executive director of the Neighborhood Parks Council, the sponsoring organization for parkscan.org. Tell me about the work of the Neighborhood Parks Council.
Okay, very good. We are an advocacy organization for parks. We are an environmental group by origin, and we started because we wanted to, you know, fix up our parks and saw that a lot of them were really being run down after kind of years of budget cutbacks for the departments. So we thought, you know, there's strength in numbers. We're going to organize a Friends of group for every one of these little parks and then become a powerful political force as well as a labor force. So we started organizing about 8 groups 10 years ago, and now 11 years ago, we have over 120 groups in our network.
Wow.
And so a lot of those groups have monthly work days. They go out every month. They're pulling weeds. They're edging. They're planting. They're doing a lot of things. They also do fundraising for projects like redoing their playground or some small kinds of projects. And then they come together once a month. We have big coalition meetings where it's kind of technical assistance about either helping you be a better park group or how do we all become a stronger political force in our city to make sure parks stays up there on the civic radar screen. And 5 years ago, we passed the first bond measure for neighborhood parks in 50 years.
Wow.
With this coalition. So we operate a lot of different levels. We also kind of have been operating as what we call, I guess, kind of de facto management consultants, because some of the issues related to parks really were management oriented. And we then decided if we often found best practices from other cities after reviewing literature and calling other cities and so on, that we could offer maybe the best ways to do certain things and try to inspire our Parks Department to, you know, reconsider the way they were doing their business. So some of that has been well received and some not very well, but we offer it anyway. And we have made, I think, some significant changes in our Park Department's management because of that aspect of what we do as well.
Who makes up your membership?
Our membership is pretty much, you know, any citizen that gets interested in parks. Some of them come together around a park group, and some of them may just be interested in that park. Some of them are interested in actually just civic responsibility. They feel like this is a way to meet people in their neighborhoods, and and they want to get together with their neighbors, and this is a good place to meet. And
can you characterize them at all by age, by income?
Oh, yes. So the age, I'd say, is pretty much over 45. Many are retired, actually, so over 55, but definitely over 45. I mean, I'd say about half and half just from guesstimating, but we don't have any real surveys. A lot of them are, you know, middle class people. I think our profile pretty much fits the profile from all the studies I've seen of volunteers in America. It's better educated, more, you know, not poverty stricken people for the most part. Now, because we do work in every neighborhood and we do outreach and around the parks where we don't have park groups because we're eager that every park be represented, we have kind of an interesting mix and a more diverse mix than I think maybe a lot of these volunteer coalitions might, and maybe in other places or on other topics. But I'd still like it to be more diverse. So we really try to keep our doors open and our eyes and ears out to include everybody.
Do you ever run into a concern, Isabel, by citizens who are taxpayers who say, well, my tax dollars go to paying for the maintenance of that park, should be going to the maintenance of that park. Why are you asking me to come out on Saturday and edge and trim and plant flowers? Shouldn't the city be doing that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in fact, one of my neighbors on my block said that to me when I was organizing my neighborhood park. and, you know, that's their approach. I can respect that. I don't think that's civic-minded. I don't think that's neighborly. And it certainly isn't as helpful for the environment as everyone getting out there and trying to do their part. But if you want to stay home, you know, that's your right.
What happens next?
So what happens next is with ParkScan, which we think is such a good tool for the community and really so exciting in terms of a lot of other applications that can be added into our basic tool right now, we're trying to roll it out nationally. And we've I think, done a pretty exciting job in San Francisco and would love to be helping other cities if we have some things to offer in that regard.
Well, I love the work you're doing, Isabel. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, thanks for having me.
Dr. Isabel Wade is Executive Director of Neighborhood Parks Council in San Francisco. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. This week's City Views commentator Walker Smith says, it's not easy being green, but what do you have to lose?
Green is today's media darling. Newspaper headlines and magazine covers trumpet the new environmentalism. Hollywood stars compete over the earnestness of their environmental sentiments. Green-minded business leaders are newly minted pop idols. Environmental activists now wield unprecedented influence on the public agenda. Countries around the world are adopting stricter environmental regulations, even the Bush administration, long resistant to the global call for restrictions on CO2 emissions, has reversed its stance. Corporations see that green is good for business. Walmart has found that more efficient resource use is as green for the bottom line as it is for the environment. Indeed, environmental attitudes are said to be at a tipping point, presaging a coming era of common cause and strict stewardship of the environment. Supposedly, green is the new black. Alas, it is not so. Consumer attitudes about the environment remain moderate at best. Every survey shows this. Let's face it. Most of us don't see enough personal relevance with environmental issues to be willing to make the sacrifices required to live environmentally friendly lifestyles. We are not necessarily wrong in our judgments. The personal benefits of greener lifestyles are not always apparent or compelling. But perhaps we should be using a different way of thinking about the environment. For something about which we know so little and have such a limited historical record to study, it seems that we should be cautious about what we change and what we consume. the more reckless and rapacious we are, the bigger the bet we are making that we have little at risk and nothing of any real value to lose. In some ways, we know already that this is a foolish bet. Consider just tropical rainforest, which have shrunk from 14% of the Earth's land surface to just 6% today and could easily be completely gone by mid-century. This takes your breath away. Literally. One-fifth of the world's oxygen is produced by the Amazon rainforest. About 25% of the Western world's pharmaceuticals come from plants in tropical rainforest, yet we have tested less than 1% of all rainforest plants. Of the 3,000 plants with ingredients that fight cancer, 70% come from tropical rainforest. 80% of the world's diet originated in tropical rainforest, including avocados, lemons, oranges, figs, coconuts, bananas, grapefruit, pineapples, corn, winter squash, yams, tomatoes, potatoes, rice, black pepper, cayenne, cloves, cane sugar, cinnamon, chocolate, vanilla, coffee, and cashews, just to mention a few. Of the 3,000 fruits found in tropical rainforest, only 200 are consumed today in Western nations. Are we smart to keep living in ways that presume we can live well or even live at all without tropical rainforest? Are we convinced that our children and grandchildren can do without tropical rainforest? Do we really believe that we know so much about tropical rainforest or the environment in general that we can get by with so much less? There is something about our lifestyles that is presumptuous and even overreaching. We are not wrong in all that we know and do, but surely we can't be right about everything either. Maybe this is why we should endeavor to be a little bit greener. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. And his forthcoming book in bookstores October 2nd is Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders who just released the new report, Kids in Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.